Weaver Institute, and I'd like to welcome you here this evening. First, as we usually do, I want to draw to your attention that you can become a member of the Institute for very little money. It's $5 for a student, $15 for an individual, and $25 for a family. Now, given that we have 11 events this year, if you're a student, that works out at about 45 cents a time. So it's a great bargain. So please, if you feel you can, on your way out, do join. Before I introduce our speaker this evening, I want to say that one of the pillars of the Institute, Nathan Nemetz, the former Chief Justice of British Columbia, died this week. Chief Justice Nemetz attended the Vancouver Institute for about five decades. In fact, the last public occasion that he was out was to the Vancouver Institute. He was here 5 weeks ago. Nathan was a man who was deeply committed to fairness and human rights, who was both humane and highly intelligent in his approach to solving problems. He made a remarkable contribution to the life of the province. He was widely respected, and he's going to be badly missed. Now, people may not be aware that his son, Peter Nemetz, is the behind-the-scenes engine for the Vancouver Institute, and I'd like, on behalf of everyone, to extend our sympathy to Peter and his family at this time. Our speaker tonight is Dean Maura Quayle. She's a BC-er, born and bred. She grew up in our West Coast landscape. And she says she chose landscape architecture because she was looking for a good mix of arts and science, and because it offered good opportunities for problem solving and for creative thinking. After she graduated from the University of Guelph in 1974, she worked for the BC provincial government. Then from 1976 to 81, she had a landscape architecture firm of her own in Victoria. She moved then to Montreal to work with a firm of architects, planners, and landscape architects, where she learned the value of interdisciplinary teams in solving physical design problems. In fact, as a result, she says she thinks that unidisciplinary firms should actually be outlawed. She went to graduate school at Berkeley, where her thesis was on design education, and in 1983, she joined UBC in landscape architecture and the School of Architecture, where she later became the director of the landscape architecture program. She's also just this last summer been made Dean of the Faculty of Agricultural Sciences. You will find out tonight that Dean Quayle has an energetic, positive, and insightful approach to things, and that's led to numerous teaching, service, and professional awards, including the YWCA Woman of Distinction Award. She's also influenced how Vancouver deals with its community greenways. I think given the current context of rapid urban growth in the lower mainland that we're all living through, I think it's very timely tonight to welcome Dean Quayle, who's going to talk about urban countryside, rural metropolis. Dean Quayle.
Thank you very much, Pat. I appreciate that introduction. Well, all of you have given up the baseball game this evening, I understand, for any baseball fans. It's certainly a pleasure to be here this evening, and it's indeed a great honor to be asked to give a lecture to the Vancouver Institute. There are two rather ordinary pictures that sit on my mother's kitchen side table in Nanaimo. One shows me at probably age 3 or 4, learning how to row with my father. It was probably stern first because he always rowed that way, and I always thought it was maybe because he liked to see where he was going when he was rowing. The other photo is set in the East Coast, Vancouver Island. I'll call it the Arbutus Rocky Landscape. And in it, my mother is kneeling down as we together examine a wildflower. Now, being at home in these landscapes seems to still allow me to actually love the urban, the city, the grit, the complexity of the everyday cultural landscape. And I think that this continuum of landscapes is at the root of my personal and my professional life. And I guess it's even more important as I begin my term as the dean of a faculty that must deal with agroecology, with sustainable resource systems, with food and nutrition systems, with family, with community, with place. So we are central to the issue of sustaining a healthy urban countryside and rural metropolis. I am seriously concerned about our futures. We need to mobilize ourselves as a community of communities to certainly better understand current challenges, but maybe more importantly, seize opportunities. Going to put the lights down, start the slides. Urban countryside, rural metropolis. This duo represents one of our most urgent challenges, especially in our bioregion. The tensions between urban and rural inhabitants and their landscapes are growing daily. The working landscape of agriculture, with its rights and responsibilities, is being threatened by other values. I believe that there are many ways to achieve a positive interdependence between urban and rural. So this lecture is an exploration of this encompassing landscape relationship. My central idea is that our current mode of operation, the techno-rational model, is missing a very important feedback mechanism. The model itself is so compelling and so powerful that it's very easy for us to spin off into new realms without seriously checking in with our core values and how they should be guiding our decisions. This happens in all areas of our lives. I'm most interested in how this model is affecting our daily needs and our experiences in our landscape. So the roadmap for the lecture is as follows. First of all, some context, some talk about land stewardship and other systems that are breaking down. Then a bit of a discussion about what's behind this breakdown. And then a description of perhaps an alternative model and what the urban countryside rural metropolis might look like under this model. A little bit about design thinking, and then a toolkit to set up seeing and perhaps shifting that model. So, explaining the breakdown. I'd like to begin with an observation. It seems to me that many of our systems are breaking down. I don't know about you, but I find it tough to read the newspaper these days. Its ability to focus on political scandals, economic disasters, or crumbling human relationships is truly amazing. But after all, they are reporting what is happening in the global community and right here in our own communities. The news is about incredible fragmentation in our roles, in our lives as people. We try to wear, I think, too many hats: good parents, excellent workers, supportive friends, caregivers, hockey coaches, computer users, financial planners, all while enjoying life. Busyness is the new credo. Book me in for lunch in 7 weeks. No time till then. It's pretty tough. We try to glue together these roles but our communities are also fragmented. In fact, our strongest community connections may be made on the telephone or in the internet. Few of us find community just down the street. Now, to zero in on my particular interest, the landscape. Perhaps the state of our land use merely reflects our social stresses. Our land is fragmented, and our systems for land stewardship are broken. For example, in the urban landscape, we've separated our workplaces from our living places, from our recreational places, so much so that moving between them is pushing our broken transportation system right to the top of the charts. The rural landscape is experiencing the same kinds of fragmentation as more demands are placed on the land to provide for a rapidly growing population. Now, two questions arise from these observations. Why? What are the root causes? And then, how do you and I respond to help to change, to repair, to heal the systems? Now, maybe one of the most puzzling aspects is why in Canada? How is it possible when we really have it all? We are next to a world economic and political superpower. We have high standards of living. We are incredibly fortunate citizens. And yet, especially our land stewardship systems are breaking down. Where are the promises of the science-technology complex and the brave new world for the end of the millennium? I'd like to touch on three possible causes for our break with the land: objectification, oversimplification, and abstraction. Objectification. The Real World of Technology by Ursula Franklin is a good book on this topic. It's actually one of the Massey lecture series. Dr. Franklin is a physicist who seems to get right to the heart of the problem with technology. She writes eloquently about the culture of compliance that technology has created, how it has turned a thinking populace into couch potatoes. The channel changer doesn't even allow us to alight long enough to really see. She's also clear about the separation that technology, since the Industrial Revolution, has brought to many day-to-day activities. Where we used to be involved in the whole thing, identifying the need, having an idea about satisfying the need, designing something, and then actually making it and using it. Now, technology has tended to separate us from the whole. We now usually participate in one small piece of the process, and it's hard to get a feel for the whole or to take any interest or ownership in it. Now, this is certainly true about food. We used to be involved in the whole shebang. We used to even have to gather the seeds. Although, that would mean absolute disaster for seed catalog aficionados. No more poring over seed catalogs, dreaming about next year's garden. Now, there's little recognition, especially at the front end of the food production system. These attitudes are rooted in a construct which understands land as commodity, people as masses or consumers, and work as labor. And without realizing it, we've severed our sense of responsibility towards the land. Another example of objectification is the transformation of the core elements in our lives from being things which we can understand and which are meaningful to us, to focusing on devices which tend to disengage us or distract us, like cars or video machines. The second possible cause of these breakdowns is oversimplification. It seems like we have a tough time seeing, and part of it is that we think that there are simple answers. And we've been taught that science has those answers. After all, the techno-rational model and way of thinking has come up with some pretty amazing ideas and applications which have very much improved our lives. There is some sense that science and technology together can tackle really any problem we may have, and that we can sit back and wait for these solutions to provide us with a stable system that we expect and perhaps need. But it isn't that simple. Resources are not infinite. It's probably impossible to be sufficiently informed about any of the decisions that we have to make. We're often surprised when our models create some unexpected and unhappy results. New science advocate Freehof Capra, in his book Web of Life, points out that simple systems create very complex behaviors, and complex systems can create simple behaviors. And it seems that even worse yet, we are oversimplifying our time horizons. We tend to live more in the future than we do in the present. And finally, abstraction. We've turned land into a commodity. We have abstracted it and in so doing disengaged our values. We have the Canada Land Inventory and land titles. We have easements and interests, corporate owners and mezzanine financing, and more statutes and bylaws that you can shake a lawyer at. We have chopped and diced this mix with engineers, more lawyers, politicians, scientists. Alfred North Whitehead, in his book, The Function of Reason, has been highly critical of techno-rational thinking. And I quote, "A few generations ago, the clergy, or to be more accurate, large sections of the clergy, were the standing examples of obscurantism. Today, their place has been taken by scientists. The obscurantists of any generation are in the main constituted by the greater part of the practitioners of the dominant methodology. Today, scientific methods are dominant, and scientists, and I'll put in brackets, engineers, any techno-rationalists, are obscurantists. And this so often happens because so much of our work is abstract. Urban countryside, rural metropolis. How has objectification, oversimplification, and abstraction affected the evolving relationship between the urban and the rural? Who is driving? Another observation is about the amazingly small land base that both houses our population and produces our food in this province. There are two triangles in the province, and imagine these, you know, bring up that map of British Columbia in your mind. Pinpoint, maybe not everybody can do this, but anyway, pinpoint Sikkimoose, Kamloops, Osoyoos, that's one triangle. Parksville, Hope, Victoria, that's the second triangle. They make up 2.7% of our entire land base in the province. They house 79% of our population. And they produce 78% of our gross farm receipts. I was so astounded when I heard these statistics that I actually checked up with Kirk Miller from the Agricultural Land Commission. Let me repeat, 2.7% of our land in those triangles. No wonder there are tensions between the urban and the rural. Nor surprisingly, nor should it surprise us, The agricultural land reserve is under constant threat from pressures to house our growing populations. We have bitter land use conflicts among farmers, preservationists, conservationists, industrialists, suburbanists, and recreationists. These conflicts are consistently in the news: Swanee Set, Money's Mushrooms, Langley Developments, and so on. They focus on different issues, from access to odor to noise. Our land and water systems are suffering pollution from many different sources. Some farmers are having a tough time making a living. The price of food is even lower than production costs. Rural doesn't mean farm anymore. Our amusement palaces are moving out into the working landscape: golf courses, theme parks. We're confused about the pros and cons of biotechnology in plants and animals. We are concerned about food security and food safety, and the list continues. The dichotomy is gone. No longer do urban and rural reflect the identities that they did even 30 or 40 years ago. I've started to visualize these situations as indicative of what I might call our spinning out model. And I'm feeling a tickle happening, so I better have a drink. It's that spinning out model. It gives me angst. So I've started to visualize the situation that we're in as this model. Life in the community is expressed in values or distilled experiences and knowledge. As we live, we have problems. We have aspirations. We have dreams. And out of those, we develop ideas, constructs, paradigms. We develop our ways of operating. We then begin to use rational technology as our way of applying ideas and allocating resources. But here is the problem. This tends to cut us off from any consideration of our values. It severs the connection which should allow values to mediate in our decision making. So we can tend to lose our grounding if we don't check in with those values, and instead we spin off and out, not relating back enough to check with those core values. So I want to talk a little bit about seeing. Why does the techno-rational model persist? Well, I think it's difficult for us to really see in the full sense of the word, to observe, to use, to really understand things. I think we've been blinded over time by some very strong cultural forces, presumptions, and assumptions. We've been living this dominant and powerful model for many generations now, possibly as a protective buffer against the often bewildering stream of information and changes around us. Yet the techno-rational model can trap us. It offers us almost like the cozy protection of a cave, absolutely complete with modern conveniences. But it also traps us away from the richness of a much more comprehensive option. Some of the products of the techno-rational model have made wonderful contributions to society, but we do need to see it for what it is and to explore well beyond it. For we do need to do what it can't do for itself, and that is to set limits and a moral context for itself. I believe that there's a more comprehensive and value-grounded option that we need to explore as an alternative. This comprehensive option places the bottom line with the land and its systems. It's a model that demands new approaches to economics and the placing of more values on community and on place. My own perspective on these issues is grounded in my own values and my own experience, like all of us. I only need to remember those two photos that so powerfully symbolize those values. And here's a time to ask us to remember children and how their values are shaped. It's also time to ask, who are we planning for? Now, thankfully, I'm not alone in thinking that an alternative is essential. Many people have suggested drawing a comprehensive model from ecology. Ecologists do important work with emphasis on synthetic thinking. However, even ecologists need to acknowledge the rich diversity of other forces at work, human, economic, and cultural, in the living world, which is our subject matter. The human and the natural are inseparably intertwined. Unlike a clean techno-rational model, any comprehensive model will get very messy at times. In The Web of Life, Capra writes about an integrated model where messiness and chaos is more than acceptable. It's in fact needed. In this model, chaos or unpredictable turbulence is a vital component of healthy living systems. Any steady state equilibrium leads in a positive feedback loop to stagnation and eventually destruction of the system. Perhaps most importantly, this comprehensive model asks us to see in a very different way. Urban countryside, rural metropolis. How might such a model be applied to the urban and rural issues that I was speaking of earlier? Now, for a long time, we have seen urban and rural as separate entities. There are papers galore written on historical and current trends. Hundreds flee from dirty and diseased cities out to the countryside. Or, lack of jobs forces people to leave small towns and live in the city. It's important to note that rural and farm no longer mean the same thing. Recently, several of us at UBC were invited to join a proposal for a Cross Canada Centre for Excellence in Sustainable Rural Communities. And when asked what was meant by rural, I was told that in the BC context, it would mean anything that wasn't Vancouver or Victoria. In the United States, they define rural as including everything that's not urban. And the urban population consists of all persons living in urbanized areas and in places of 2,500 persons or more. Urban and rural. Defining one through the other no longer works particularly well when our urban ideals seem to be to give everyone a piece of the farm in suburbia. Now, there's a general acceptance that food lands are important to us. But how important in an era of our urban invasion of the rural? Landscape architect Bob Riley writes, "The humanized, non-urban landscape throughout human history has been almost completely shaped by people who worked and lived on that land. However, the new non-urban landscape is being shaped largely by people to whom the rural landscape is nothing more and nothing less than an alternative residential location. Whether they be commuters, retirees, desktop publishers earning a living from their den, to them the rural landscape is not a productive system or a way of life, but it's a locational amenity. This is a big problem. And it's not one simply solved by techno-rational solutions that some of our professions might wish to offer. Let's look at the Greater Vancouver Regional District. Between 1991 and 96, a five-year period, the number of farms grew. We have 402 more farms. But the acreage in farms declined from about 107,000 to 98,000. Gross farmer seats increased 44%. The market value of farms in the GVRD in 1995 was $3.1 billion. Indications are that the value of farm output has grown at twice the rate of the provincial economy. Now, the region accepts around the population of the West End each year, about 40,000 or so. More people, more cars, less arable land, nothing new, but something's happening in our region that will affect our concepts of urban and rural. The concept of urban countryside, rural metropolis, emphasizes a different approach to urban and rural issues. Integration and cooperation are the watchwords. What would happen if we intentionally melded the countryside and the metropolis in terms of how we think about them? This would mean strengthening distinctive communities, ones that had responsibilities to each other. This is quite different from the kind of rapacious growth that is characterizing the current urban invasion. Well, what should the characteristics of urban countryside and rural metropolis be? Well, first of all, they must have a strong landscape structure. Both urban and rural landscapes desperately require this structure, and this structure must be based on ecological systems that underpin them. Now, what do I mean by landscape structure? Well, traditionally, the lands that you and I own collectively, in other words, the public realm, form the key to that framework. In the urban context, greenways, streets, open space can provide a very strong public structure to ensure that we experience connectivity and an ease of movement in various transportation modes. The green zone, food lands, green lands, theoretically create landscape structure in our region. Now, in many ways, the idea of urban countryside and rural metropolis, the idea supports Bill Reese's concept of the ecological footprint. Many of you may have read Bill's op-ed piece in last week's Sun, where he wrote, "Ecological footprinting shows that the average Canadian requires at least 5 hectares of ecologically productive land and water in continuous production to supply the resources that she or he consumes." 5 hectares is over 3 city blocks. So one of the compelling reasons to integrate our urban and rural psyches better is to reduce our ecological footprint. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to arrive at this being a prudent conclusion by combining concepts of, well, they aren't making land anymore, and increasing population pressures. We need to recognize that this is for the public good, and that that public is you and I and our neighbors and our children. This public good is an essential value for the rebuilding and integrating of the countryside and the metropolis. According to John Ralston Saul, the Canadian author of Unconscious Civilization, Socrates' quest was to determine the conduct of our life, how each of us should conduct her or himself to live the most advantageous life. I believe that the citizen and the public good remain absolutely critical concepts to our future. They must be again understood and woven into our strategies of community building at all scales, from the park bench to the city council bylaws to federal and provincial statutes. One aspect of this landscape structure is the green zone that's on the books in our region. And certainly having the food lands and the green lands blocked out on the plans influences people's thinking. And this is good. But this idea of protecting and nurturing our ecological and agricultural heritage and inheritance has yet to be integrated adequately into our regional and municipal planning and design frameworks. Well, it's the same old song, at least I seem to sing it a lot, about ensuring that all
that the public structure is in place. And that public structure includes a variety of types of infrastructure, not just the stuff we don't see, like hydro, gas, and water, but the vital ecological infrastructure that is enabled by specific open spaces that treat runoff and wastewater, that provide animal habitat, that allow aquifer recharge, and that encourage different modes of transportation and recreation. Now, a note of caution about the conservationist who espouses preservation as the solution to ecological disintegration, or the politician who takes comfort in a statistic for protected lands. They imply that some parts of the world should be preserved, while others openly abused or destroyed. I can see that in some ways it would be easy for this attitude to take hold in our region. Oh, well, at least we have the green zone. We can protect it and pillage the rest. Thus, the countryside and the metropolis both need our stewardship. The urban and the rural are both at risk. Commonwealth. This discussion about public structure leads us into a second concept that I think is important in terms of the characterization of our future vision for urban and rural. And that's the notion of what is commonwealth, and I'm talking two words, lowercase. We currently have notions of private property, public property, and commonwealth, and we tend to value them about in that order. I think our valuing is, in fact, backwards. Wendell Berry, writer, poet, farmer, maintains that we have not thought very well or very thoroughly about any of these. Berry sees hope as rooted in the idea of commonwealth. The concept acknowledges that we all have a common interest or share in the land, an interest that precedes and underpins our notion of legal, private, and public property rights. Our right to live as we choose must be tempered by obligations of respect for others, our culture, and our land. It was interesting to note that in this month's Wired magazine, Miss Manners was featured. And Miss Manners was observing that the natural evolution of etiquette on the internet was at issue. And it seems to me that we can transfer that to say, why can't we see the same imperatives in terms of respect for our land? Each of us who owns private property has an obligation, therefore, to use the property in such a way as to not impair or diminish the common interest in it. This obligation on part of the landowner implies a simultaneous obligation on all the users as part of society as a whole. If our legislatures represent our social systems, our social values in systems of land ownership, then in effect, we should see that the landowner is able to afford not only to use the land, but also to properly care for it. This is an incredibly crucial issue at a time of soil depletion, urban sprawl, farm closures. Commonwealth needs to be appreciated in the urban context too, in terms of how we treat our urban, private, and public lands. And yet, the concept of commonwealth does not hold social esteem, in part because we have stopped teaching and understanding it, and in part because it doesn't pay. We give farmers the responsibilities to produce food on our behalf, but for very little economic return. At the same time, we saddle them with our expectations for the care of the land on our behalf, also for very little economic return. We expect special stewardship as a society, but we are unwilling to pay for it. This, according to Wendell Berry, is the cheap food and therefore anti-farming policy. As part of any new model of thinking about the urban and the rural, they have to be intimately linked, and we must clarify our attitudes and values about these food production systems. Now, currently, food production is located mainly on the rural lands. Well, what would happen if we shifted responsibility for some of the food production to the urban? What if we consciously brought more of the countryside work into the city? Now, this has started in small ways with community gardens and the general citizen gardener. But what if we had a policy that insisted on integrating food production into absolutely every community? The Fraser Valley supports intensive agriculture now. Well, we haven't seen anything yet. This is one strategy to help us reduce our ecological footprint. Using rooftops of both housing and larger industrial and commercial buildings, why not think about greenhouses on roofs? So that food production zones increase and begin to significantly change our footprint. Currently, we produce just over 50% of our food in British Columbia. We import the rest. Imagine going into Safeway and finding one half of the food just not there. We should be changing that. Something as necessary as food shouldn't be at the mercy of international trade agreements, import laws, and transnational corporations. But more importantly, if we integrated food production, we might once again respect food and give it value. For food safety and security are important issues. Buy local, buy BC has a good ring to it. I want to talk a little bit about particularness or uniqueness and place. So would the urban countryside and rural metropolis look the same? Certainly not. The landscape and its characteristics should direct the development patterns and the details that involve. Instead of the blur of suburbia, we need to make sure that our communities are concentrated, whether they be urban neighborhoods or more like rural crossroads or even villages. Both have their rhythms, their smells, their own special beauty. In a similar way that urban neighborhoods have distinct identities, the communities that we grow in the rural metropolis must too have their unique qualities emphasized. This is totally in sync with the idea of an ecological bottom line and the importance of having an adaptive system. We have so much to gain from returning to local, land-based economies that are very place-specific. Delta is as different from Maple Ridge as Langley is different from Surrey. This carries us towards the ecological and cultural ideal of local adaptation. We should be focusing on building local prosperity to invigorate communities in this countryside metropolis. Local prosperity. Jane Jacobs, in her 1984 book, Cities and the Wealth of Nations, suggests that the best approach is to build around enterprising individuals and groups that see a local opportunity, and by improvising, adapting, and substituting, they can make this local enterprise happen. Now, initially, these efforts start on a small scale, and they usually aim to serve a local market. But it makes so much sense to build on the local. The very character of the landscape, whether recreation lands, food lands, or housing lands, can be economic edge and generator for the development of real place-focused economies. Now, why does the idea that economies ought to support communities sound so utopian? Well, it seems utopian only because human needs seem to be considered secondary to abstractions of world markets and sustained growth. It also seems utopian because we as citizens and neighbors still do not seem to be seeing in a way that allows us to support wise decisions at a political level. So who is going to care for this commonwealth? If we want both the urban countryside and the rural to be cared for, then we must have people living on the land and from the land, in both the urban streetscape condition and the rural foodlands. There must be people there who are willing and able to care for it. We need to revisit our system of land rights and economics. Until we revitalize the rural metropolis through some different community building strategies and actually recognize its importance, we'll have a tough time finding a complete solution to the protection and management of land. And these strategies have to include rewards, attendant new jobs, new benefits for stewardship, and renewed recognition of comprehensive and long-term values, not short-term gain. In general, I think of this urban countryside rural metropolis as hybridized models. Just like in the crossbreeding of peas for better resulting varieties, what if we used our concepts of urban and rural as two strong parents? Can you see the offspring as a hybrid of the qualities of the farmyard, of our current backyard, and our current front yard? I see focused communities that allow an appropriate mix of the rough, maybe it's a wild meadow, or maybe it's a textured crop, and the refined, the clipped grass, the shiny greenhouse, with a great emphasis on a working and a learning landscape. The children's garden and the environmental yard that schools seem to fail to build finally might find a home in the urban countryside and rural metropolis. The student-run food co-op may find a home in the old barn at the end of South End of Main Mall. And the urban shadow over the farmlands may become dotted with some sunlight. These places where we want to live and work have to promote a not-so-fast kind of experience between the urban tempo and the natural rhythm, the contact with strangers in the public realm, through mediators like dogs, babies, through simultaneous or experiences like watching a baseball game, or even by occupying the same bench. At some very human level, we need to work to make this hybrid happen. There must be an emphasis on the biophysical considerations as the bottom line. Ecological processes should be made explicit, whether this is in the most dense urban area or the most open rural food landscape. In both, we require incredibly stringent ecological performance standards. Our survival depends on it. We are struggling with how to grow communities, and this becomes even more important in the integration of the countryside and the metropolis. The process must be characterized by collaboration and by incremental growth based on new bottom lines, ecological infrastructure, local economy, emphasis on food production. Community choices must inform the process. And of course, governance is also important. Regional issues require overall planning. Local communities require in-the-backyard solutions. We're overdue to find more workable ways to govern the countryside and the metropolis, with emphasis on the notions of common wealth. Emphasis on a variety of performance criteria for these urban and rural landscapes is another way to look at it. Our lives would be more balanced if we didn't just choose to focus on the economic, but we folded in considerations about our everyday experience. Walking outside in the morning, feeling refreshed, not depending on 3 weeks in Hawaii to do one's restoration. We need to consider community building, ecology, and most importantly, beauty. Now there's a word that's scarcer than hen's teeth. And there's a very agricultural expression.
Anyway, beauty is absolutely necessary to our souls, our urban countrysides and rural metropolises should be beautiful. A change in work patterns. One of the aspects of considering an alternative model for our land and for our lives has to do with this relationship between home and work. Recently, the New York Times Magazine featured an article called Work, Sweet Work, which explored how people are finding an enjoyable community at work and nothing but aggravation at home. This is a heads up about our work-home relationship. It's also connected to transportation issues. What if we begin to take home work much more seriously? What if you were penalized if you came into the office more than one day a week? Instead, you work at home, and during coffee breaks or lunches, you come out and you socialize with your community at home. You would see your family more, your neighbors would become your socialization unit of primary importance. It would then make sense to have places to walk to and cycle to on that daily basis. It seems like the opportunities are there to invent new ways of working and living in these hybrid landscapes. Farmers work at home generally. Maybe it's a model that the rest of us can follow. Now, I don't think these ideas are utopian. Instead, I see them as the opening of new possibilities based on a different model of operation, which is open, creative, and grounded in our values. This is all fine and well, you say. But how do we make such apparently major shifts in our thinking? How do we get back to really seeing? In many ways, this is what landscape architecture is about. As physical designers, we're always asking questions about how to actually make and build places where we want to live and work. We're constantly connecting our policies with the reality of what it looks like on the ground, what it feels like. This design way of thinking in terms of creative process is actually quite useful in re-seeing. So what are some of the characteristics or behaviors that we might encourage to help us see better? Well, some of them are typical conditions for creativity. In fact, one of the most important aspects of design education is coming to grips with that courage to create. Rollo May writes in his book of that name, "Whereas moral courage is the righting of wrongs, creative courage, in contrast, is the discovering of new forms, new symbols, new patterns on which a new society can be built." So I think we need to, firstly, be very open to experience. It's so necessary for us to be open in every way to experience, to have new ideas, to think about new ways of approaching our lives. We've got to have the ability to toy with elements and concepts, to be constructively critical, and to also play with ideas. Some of us have had this ability to play beaten out of us early in life, but we have to recapture that ability and have fun with ideas and concepts, piecing them together in different ways. We also have to get a lot better at practicing deferred judgment. How often do you get an idea, and generally, before you've even given birth to that idea in terms of giving it voice, your powerful critic, I don't know about yours, but mine sits just right here behind my right ear, your powerful critic puts the kibosh on that idea and says, "Oh, that's a silly idea." If ideas are allowed to see the light of day, we learn from them and we build upon them. And in an age of great confusing, stressful, and enormously promising historical transition, as Walter Anderson refers to our current times, we also need to support each other in making informed decisions from these deferred judgments. We also need to practice fluency and flexibility, the ability to generate a whole range of different ideas, and the ability to look at an idea and find variation within it. We have to learn to define problems comprehensively. So often it seems like we aren't really attacking the right problem, or we haven't defined it clearly enough to know how to approach its resolution. We also need to be excellent listeners and excellent question askers. We spend a lot of time in landscape architecture trying to teach listening and questioning behavior. These are basic citizen skills. So, in essence, to start re-seeing in some ways, we need to connect to our own creativity as individuals and as a society. Rollo May explains that creativity is every individual's encounter with his or her world. So what about a toolkit of strategies? What if the urban countryside and rural metropolis concept of integration intrigues us? And by learning to really see again, our senses suggest that we might think there's some possibilities of moving in that direction. Well, how do we take action? What kinds of attitudes should we foster? Or what strategies do we need? I think in a sense we need to build a toolkit of both general and specific strategies that individuals and communities can use to move this process along. As usual, it takes education, literacy of all kinds. We talk quite a bit about illiteracy at a verbal level, but what about the visual, the spatial, environmental or ecological literacy, intercultural literacy? All of these need to be taught. They are critical in making sure we educate good citizens with environmental and cultural competence. Get the big picture, but emphasize the local and specific. We need to realize that the best results are those when people share decisions and their consequences. I think too often we tend to equate national and provincial laws with the objective or something that we can believe and depend on. Somehow the more specific, individual, or community considerations are often considered to be subjective or relative and thus dismissed. The emphasis on smaller-scale decision-making set in the context of the Commonwealth seems like it might be a fruitful strategy. Increasingly effective land use management exemplifies the struggle to move away from the purely objective and the universal and to engage in the local. Many of the greenway and public way projects in the city of Vancouver, for instance, have been attempts to build community in a way that recognizes unique problems have unique solutions. The standard procedure, well, let's take concrete curbing, for example, is often the most inappropriate and the most expensive solution. But the road to the specific and the particular is fraught with techno-rational roadblocks. The only way I know to keep challenging this is to use our landscape as a laboratory and incrementally try out new things, and old things for that matter, that respond to the very particularness of a place. Here are some what-if pilot projects that might move us towards some integration. Community-supported agriculture, short form CSA. These are joint ventures between consumers and farmers to produce food. The most common model is where the consumers actually put up the money early in the season to become shareholders in that season's harvest. and the farmers provide the expertise to grow the food. In more consumer-initiated models, a community group might rent or acquire land, set a budget, and hire farmers. Most CSAs raise fresh vegetables as their primary product, and as a concept, they have their roots in Japan and Switzerland, where they're quite common. What if we try CSAs as a beginning of our countryside metropolis connection? A BC Trust for Public Lands. It's probably way past time to consider land trusts as strategies for helping us encourage new approaches to farming and food production, as well as ways to create the necessary landscape structure of greenways, public ways, and other ecological infrastructure. The idea of a BC Trust for Public Lands is that we can tap into the billions of dollars of intergenerational wealth, people who want to either give their lands or their estates for the public good. These resources can then be managed towards helping our integration process. For example, a land trust may be a way to experiment with growing some smaller communities that are based in the common wealth principle. And some entrepreneurial ideas. In Switzerland, farming is part of the tourist trade. Scenic beauty is so important that farmers get paid to delay their hay harvest until the mountain flowers bloom. The Swiss have made the direct connection between their landscape as a multifaceted resource to locals or visitors and to the viability of farming. They also subsidize farms to help maintain that timeless and picturesque image of Switzerland. The government in Switzerland is subsidizing as well a shift towards organic farming with increased emphasis on both animal welfare and environmental regulations. This is an example of valuing the agricultural resource, a value which underpins the connection between countryside and metropolis. To care or not to care, to stay or to go. I think all of us are in some ways torn between caring and not caring, staying and going. The urban countryside and rural metropolis, with their communities and neighborhoods, are only as successful as the people who participate in them and are inspired to put their personal energy into caring and staying. What are the keys to help us harness our own energies and those of others to work towards the model of integrating the urban countryside and the rural metropolis? Well, the first to me is to target your own energies, to find a small project that you can get your teeth into and that you believe in, and then you become like a dog with a bone, all the while checking in with the bigger context so you stay open and tuned in, but targeted on that project. Secondly, I think we have to establish a habit of communicating with our decision makers at whatever level, federal, provincial, local, you are comfortable with, and in whatever way. Apparently, one letter or email is worth about 40 signatures on a petition. One of the assignments that my creativity and design class undertakes is to follow a public process of their choice, to understand it and critique it. And then they must write a letter to an individual with some control over that process to either suggest improvements, make comments, or ask questions. I think this is one way to ingrain a habit of advocacy within our citizenry. After all, as the United Way slogan says this year, great communities have great citizens. And, as my boss says, think about it. Thank you. How did I do? Was I too long?
No, that's right. I'm right here.
Oh. Dean Quayle is going to take some questions, so could we ask you, if you hear it, to repeat it to the mic?
Will do. Okay. Yes. The question is to identify the roles that the municipal governments will need to play, that the regional governments will need to play, and the provincial government will need to play in moving us along to this new model. Is that the gist of the question? Yes. Well, have we got all night? I guess I'll start with the, I was warned about you. What I should have done is phoned you up and said, what's the question going to be? No, that's true. I think at the local level, there's an incredible amount of leadership that can occur from our councils in our variety of municipalities. But it's going to require that they understand this integration process, and that happens specifically at their staff level. That's what I'm going to zero in on. Because right now, there's a tendency for, Pat mentioned my abhorrence of unidisciplinarity. Well, the most exciting moment for me in the last few years was when our first landscape architecture graduate was hired by the engineering department at the City of Vancouver. Because that to me meant that there was a hope that the Greenways program was going to have people in it that didn't have disciplinary hats on, but they had public realm hats on. And that's the difference. That in fact there's a meeting of all of these different disciplines in solving the kinds of problems that we have at all of those governmental levels. I guess I would make that comment about the people that we have working in our planning and engineering departments require that kind of integration. That also says something about what we're doing here at the university and the absolutely essential aspect of educating somebody who can speak the language and understand this interdisciplinary and incredible challenge that we've got. At the regional level, I guess I'm getting pretty frustrated around the transportation issues. We need some leadership from the provincial level to give the region some power to say, look, watersheds, airsheds don't know these little boundaries. We have to think much more broadly about how decisions are made in that aspect. And, you know, I'm not sure that we're having enough discussions. We've been through a lot of processes, but I'm not sure that we're having the right kinds of discussions. And an example I'll give you is at the Green Zone Conference last March, where we were talking about greenways, we were talking about agricultural land, we were talking about tools for working with the land, and we were in separate groups. Uh-uh, that doesn't work. We have to be together fighting it out. Yes?
What do you see as the implications of this new transportation authority that's being set up?
Well, I guess I'm an optimist. Oh, sorry, the question, I forgot. The question is what I see the implications are of the new transportation authority that's being set up. I guess I'm an optimist because I see it as, first of all, a move that is the recognition that, you know, we have some major problems. I guess one of my problems is at the same time that that's happening, there was the announcement of $100 million to be spent on new roads. And I just looked at that and went, we don't get it. We aren't seeing. And so it'll depend what the mandate of that particular group is. And I think it's the university's responsibility to be making comment on broadening the perspective. So, yes. The question is, how does the idea of urban countryside, rural metropolis, translate into the building of a new community at UBC in the South Campus? I think that the potential of that community and building a community at UBC is incredible. I think that it's quite possible within the confines of the official community plan that we have now to introduce very much the idea of a much more integrated notion about what a community is. I don't believe that that's outside of the possibilities. I think that if anything, that our challenge at UBC is to, in fact, make that community, is to do that integration. We have all the disciplines here. We have the capability to actually lead the way in how we make that integration. And so I think it requires all of us to keep pushing and to, in a sense, identify what we value. I'm not sure that we're good at doing that. I'm not sure that we're good at communicating what we actually value as people in our everyday experience. And of course, we have different values, but I think that we don't talk about them enough. Yes? The question is about how globalization and attitudes about the global village, how all those attitudes are influencing how we may be shaping our communities. Well, it's interesting that you should bring that up, because in the Faculty of Agricultural Sciences right now, we're going through a transformation, and one of the issues that we're talking about is what does globalization mean? Is that different than globalism? And how do we prepare our students for this new era? And I think that the conclusion that we're coming to is that the context, the global context, has to inform us very much in an intercultural way, that the importance of our students understanding different cultures and going to different places to understand those cultures is in fact to connect them with their own values, so that they understand community, they understand place in a totally different way. And so I think in many ways the problem that the sort of corporate world can sometimes bring to community building is that it isn't broad enough. It hasn't had enough variety of experience folded into it. So I think that the potential of the of the global context is in fact that intercultural potential. And you know, we in this particular countryside metropolis have this wonderful rich possibility. And so I think it really is up to us to keep talking about that in very positive terms. Well, the question is how can we let a situation like the Downtown East Side evolve and not be able to come to grips with it? Well, one, I don't have a very good answer to this, but one of my professors at Berkeley explained planning problems as wicked problems, and they are indeed wicked problems. I think that as we face social problems that interrelate with environmental problems, I think that we're trying to explore to find answers. And the only way that I can suggest to improve what we do is to talk to the people that are there and listen. It's not just talk, it's listen to the people who are there. One last question. Uh-oh. Oh, sorry. Up. You look very impatient, so maybe I better...
Not at all impatient, but very appreciative of what was said to us this evening. Is there one great area of Vancouver, one specific locality, one huge opportunity for us to integrate what you've been talking about with this lecture for the coming millennium? Is there
Sure. The whole thing. No. Well, if you, are you, is your question about the more Vancouver area where there might be a landscape that is still left for us to experiment with?
Yeah.
Well, one of my favorite landscapes, I call it the False Creek Flats. It's the railway lands between Clark and the golf ball, and Pryor and Great Northern Way. I think that it's indeed possible to take this kind of attitude with those lands, but it's going to take some real gutsy moves on the part of our local politicians to say landscape structure, to say environmental bottom line. And I'm not sure that we've got the guts there right now. But anyway, that's one place that has incredible potential. I guess, you know, remember I said target? Well, my target is this whole idea of greenways and public ways, both in the region and in the city. And I see that if in this city we could get that greenway public way network there, that public structure there, that we would be quite a ways ahead, especially if we used it as very much as an alternative transportation possibility. And so if we really put our energy behind that, we could change the way our city operates. And as a result, I think there'd be a ripple effect in how other communities operate.
I think that's a very good note on which to stop. I'm going to ask Professor Emeritus Michael Shaw, who's a former Vice President of UBC, to thank our speaker.
Well, what can I say? What I'd really like to say is that's our mora. When I left the administrative swamp and returned to the Department of Plant Science in 1983, I found myself surrounded by this happy band of landscape architects that included Mora and Doug Patterson and later on Pat Mooney. And I quickly became aware that they had a breadth of interest and an insight that I was that I was totally lacking in. And I really came to appreciate their point of view. Now, the other point I want to make is that not long ago, when Mora was appointed Dean of Agricultural Sciences, a distinguished agriculturist said to me, "What's happening to the faculty? How can you possibly have a landscape architect as dean?" And I said, "You don't know Mora." And I think you can see from her talk today, tonight, that she is very well aware of the importance of the land, both the urban land and the rural land, of the importance of the environment, of developing what I would call a humanistic urban ecology, as well as a humanistic agricultural ecology, and the links between the two. I think it's fortunate that we have a dean with such a wide perspective now, and I wish you all the luck in the world. I know that you face some very difficult problems. One I would like to remind you about, and that is that academics as a whole have a very restricted view of science. When they think about the history of science and its social role, they think about physics, mathematics, and cosmology, and maybe chemistry. Biology and the biosciences, they tend to lump under the name of biomedical sciences, as if all that concerned that biology was concerned with was the curing of human illnesses. They have a very wrong view of the history of science. Agriculture, one can make the argument, was the first science, the mother of all the sciences. It is still important today, and it always will be. It makes life possible for humans, it feeds the world, and it needs to be integrated with what goes on in the metropolis. Thank you.